Hello, this is Lori Elster, and you're listening to the All Access Star Trek podcast. Tony is headed to the STSF Trek to San Francisco convention, so we don't have a new episode for you this week, but what we do have is a re-release of our fun and very lively interview from last summer with Chris Fisher, the producing director and co-executive producer of Star Trek Strange New Worlds. They're currently in production on season 3 of the show in Toronto, so it seemed like a good choice for a re-release. Enjoy!
So I want to welcome Chris Fisher, who is the producing director on Star Trek Strange New Worlds. Welcome, Chris.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We're excited to talk to you about Strange New Worlds.
Oh, I can't wait.
But I think before we even jump into that, let's be topical and talk about the strikes for a moment. Would love to get your thoughts on what's going on with the actor strike, the writer strike, and the latest offer. I guess you could put it in quotes.
Yeah.
from the AMPTP.
This may be a short conversation. I think what we've learned at this stage is that nobody knows, because I think we've all done, everyone that is an insider or knows someone, you know, that's an insider, we've all reached out to all our sources in this desperate and terrible time to, hey, what's really going on? What is really happening? And every time I make that call, I get an answer that completely doesn't pan out. My guess as to that reason is that there's not consensus at the top of the studios. I think Amazon doesn't agree with Paramount, and Disney doesn't agree with Netflix, and Apple doesn't agree with Warner Brothers. I don't think there's consensus with the AMTP. We know what we want. You know, I've been a proud WGA member since 2004 and DGA since 2005. I was on the DGA, part of the DGA negotiating team. I was a pod leader for that, so I was involved with that. The DGA deal points, I still feel were good. The writers have totally different issues, and so do the actors. So it's not the same thing. And you know, I think DGA, WGA, and SAG-AFTRA are 100% unified right now. I don't think it's the same on the other side. And I think that's why there's so much chaos and uncertainty. I don't think the new tech Hollywood wants to do business the same way that the old studio Hollywood does. And it's no secret that those companies don't like each other.
I'm confused this week that there was a meeting. It sounded like there was progress. But then there's been press releases fired back and forth, and I can't tell whether there was actually progress or was this all grandstanding so it's hard to tell at this point. Do you have any insight into this? The latest offer from the AIM, was this all BS or was it a reasonable offer to at least show progress?
I mean, I haven't actually looked at it in detail. I sort of, you know, took a look at, there's a couple people, Amy Berg and David Slack, who are very involved on the WGA side, who are friends of mine, who I very much respect. I had kind of waited for their responses, and you know, they thought it was, you know, what was grandstanding and bullshit for the most part. So, but I think, you know, the big issues, you know, are really at this point, you know, performance-based residuals. Like, how are these shows really doing? And I don't think they've had meaningful agreement on that yet. And of course, AI, which so complex, we could spend a whole issue on that, you know, a whole podcast on that alone. But, you know, to me, it's strange because, you know, so far the courts and the Library of Congress have all come out in support of humans and said that AI art is not copyrightable. So to me, that's sort of the end of the story. Like they right. can't, if the studios can't copyright these, an AI movie or an AI performance, or if something, some part of an artwork is uncopyrightable, then they can't profit off it. That's sort of telling us, guys, that this is not the way to go.
You talked about the performance and all that. Were you guys surprised or not surprised to see, you know, we've been writing articles about how Strange New Worlds has been doing well at the Nielsen's ratings. You guys had no feedback whatsoever. You'd never heard anything from someone inside saying we're doing well, we're not doing well.
You know, I'm an executive producer on the show, but as probably you guys know, not all executive producers are created right. the same.
Right.
Television is very much a showrunner run business. So our showrunners, Akiva and Henry, you know, they very well may be getting more privileged information than me. I'm on the weekly shout outs, which are, I think executive producer only, weekly shout outs from Paramount Press and stuff like that, letting us know, all the great articles and stuff like that. They never have ratings on that. The ratings we get are from all these third party groups but it isn't coming from any official source. So that's frustrating, but it seems like there's enough. And again, I usually get those, like someone will tweet it to me or text it to me like, hey, did you see our show's number one? Or did you, and I'll send it to Henry and Akiva and like, did you see our show? It would be great to, if that truly is the case, which I believe it is, it'd be great to really know that and to, if you're going to make a great show, it's great to have that be official and be made public and use that to keep promoting the show. That would be in the studio's favor.
It's certainly how it used to work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we used to brag about it,
Right.
And when a show was a hit, going back to my days on Person of Interest, being, on that show, like when we were a top show, we use that to get the top directors and you get great, better actors. We wouldn't necessarily use it to go ask for more money. We would ask, we'd use it to make the show better, to improve the art and to attract the best people. And, everyone wanted to be on something that was doing great.
I'm curious, when you guys are shopping for directors, is it easy to track talent, director talent?
Oh yeah. I have the best job in the world. I mean, not just because my showrunners are fantastic and really support me on the director side and what my role and job is up in Toronto. But it's basically, everyone's dying to do it. We do something very special here. We do something that hasn't happened on a Trek series before. We do 10 Star Trek movies a year. And we hire 10 directors for those 10 Star Trek movies. I'm the executive producer. I could give myself more than one. Akiva could certainly direct more. We don't, because we think we found the magic sauce. And our magic sauce is we don't block episodes. We don't crossboard. We don't hire a roster of directors and say, hey, you can come do this one. Or if you do something else, then I'll give you this one. Like, that's how we lost Jonathan Frakes season one, because that was an emotional loss. I love that man. But we lost him because when the episode that we hire you for, we start developing it with you. Like we hire directors in a completely different way than on any show I've ever worked on. Different than any Trek show. The funny thing, or the fun thing, is that when I give this pitch to directors in my initial meeting with them, they've all heard this before from other shows. They're like, yeah, but they don't believe me. Then the next, once they get hired, when we start sending them, we're getting very involved early on in our AR sets and our world building, which is another part of our magic sauce to why the show's, I think, looks so great, is we start getting them involved in all this stuff early on, just like they're doing a movie. And they make choices through the entire process like they're making a movie. They can do anything they want. Akiva and Henry have said to me, that we've all been involved in TV shows where the person who has my job, the producing and directing job, kind of can be more sometimes a creative cop. And I think it was Akiva's exact words, which very much inspired me. And he's like, Fish, you're their patron. You are the patron of these directors. You are there to give them everything they possibly want. Let someone else, clip their wings. Be their patron. And I ran with it, of course, because wow, what a great job that sounded like. I want to do that, and that's what we've done. It's created a lot of problems for us, again, because we don't rotate directors, we don't move episodes around, and we've lost some good directors when schedules are changed and things have happened, because we really feel like this is our magic. This is what's different. This is why And the word is spread around. You know, people in town know this. They want to come direct our show. Everyone does.
You said you do everything differently. How do you pair a director to an episode, which, as you said, are each is, you know, the whole point of the show, or not maybe the point, but
yeah,
the style of the show is everything's different. So, you know, did you have a board up at the beginning of the year and it said like time travel, crossover, musical, and then you had a board of directors and you're like, this guy's better for, you know, because it seemed obvious, the musical guy, you got the guy who did the, you know, so how's that whole process work of pairing directors to...
You just stole my entire DNA. So that's exactly it. So we have – so – and we can talk about this a little bit when we talk about the AR. Well, you know, our show has to run differently for a lot of different reasons. And most Star Trek shows do because, you know, there's not many sets you can go to or props you can buy from a store or costumes you can go buy at a store that look like Star Trek. Everything's bespoke. Everything has to be made. Every detail, every stitch, every set, everything is bespoke on a show. So we have to get way ahead. This is not, you know, we need our season break many, many months before we start production. Many months before we start even early prep. We have great showrunners who know that. So at the end of season one, and this was so awesome. And again, this kind of stuff that just doesn't happen on any other show. At the end of season one, Akiva and Henry flew up to Toronto with all the writers. They locked themselves. We gave them a room at the production offices. And they locked themselves in a room and basically like, we're not leaving until we've broken season two kind of for you guys. And they did it. And Frank Siracusa, one of our executive producers, myself, you know, Jonathan Lee, our production designer, Glenn Keenan, our DP, Bernadette Croft, our costume designer, you know, some key people, Jason Zimmerman, our VFX producer, some key people also came to this meeting and they basically, here's the whole season. Here's what you guys are going to go do. So, you know, so that means we never really got a true hiatus. We were like, so I immediately after that, I'm searching for directors. I'm putting out the net. So here's what we need. Here's what we have to find. You know,
now you don't have scripts here.
No, I don't know if we actually even had anything in writing for a while, but they basically just said it was, you know, straight from the horse's mouth. Like, here it is, you know? So they just, here's our 10 genres. Here are our 10 worlds. This is what we're going to do. And, you know, again, the musical we started prepping before, and that was episode 9, you know, that we started prepping that before we even started prepping the premiere. That's how far ahead we had to get of stuff like that. So I guess the good news of just big budget Star Trek TV in general, and especially our show, which again, episodes aren't easy to move and directors aren't easy to move, is that we do, the showrunners know they have to start the storytelling process early. And perhaps the biggest beneficiary of that is production, which is my domain. My executive producer, VIP pass does not work for the writer's room. Unless I'm delivering coffee, I don't get in that room, but getting those writers working early, getting the minds on it, getting, you know, Akiva and Henry, you know, really are big brain bugs, you know, just getting those guys, just, you know, get Akiva in a room to concept a Star Trek show is like, you know, he's never been happier. I've never seen anyone happier than letting him use his mind for something like that. But production is the big beneficiary and the directors are.
So just for everyone listening, can you describe your role on the show, like specifically?
In a nutshell, I'm in charge of directors, visual language, and everything production related in Toronto.
I like that you're already saying Toronto like a native. I'm from Toronto, so you're saying it without that second T. So A plus for you. You've been there a while.
It's my second. It's my second time living up there. My second show up there. It's the best place in the world to make film. It's such a cinephile city. It's crazy. My career began in the independent film world, and it was always, if you know, you'd go to Sundance and half the people would walk out. You go to Telluride, you know, people would boo your movie. But you go to Toronto and you got a standing ovation. Like,
oh, yeah.
You know, it was like they love cinema. You know, bring them anything. They'll eat it. Yeah, it's a great place to live. It's a great place to work. We have a fantastic crew. But yeah, so my job in a nutshell is to – I'm the number two guy underneath the showrunners. The showrunners stay wherever – you know, wherever the studios are, wherever the writer's room is and wherever the edit room is. So the studios, if your mothership here is the studio wants to keep their writers and their editors nearby, keep them close. They want to control the process, but they want to go make the show for the least amount of money they can. So they want to go to a tax incentive place usually. And I'm the person who goes. So the showrunners stay, oversee the writer's room, oversee editorial, and then I get sent to wherever the show gets made. Yeah, and you know, everything to do with the actors, everything to do with the directors, everything to do with set design, everything to do with the AR wall, which is my, you know, my real, the new love of my life. That's stuff that I get to handle.
I'm curious when you, you know, because we have these different styles, and as you were saying, directors love it when you guys actually mean that they're allowed to express themselves in different ways. But like, are you like when you bring someone in and say, okay, this is, you know, this is going to be like episode 8 was war movie, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, you brought in Jeff Burt, yeah, right? And I actually talked to him a little bit about this, but do you say like, here's an episode of Deep Space Nine we like, you know, and here's a particular war movie we like. How do you give them a, you know, visual cue so that they know to make it different than, you know, another episode of Strange New Worlds?
Well, certainly there are those references given to the director, 100%. You know, for 208 with Jeff Bird, Davey Perez was who's also an executive producer and writer. He had a very clear vision. The vision was clear in the script. It was a fabulous script. So in one of the first meetings, if not the first meeting, will be your concept meeting, and sort of that's when the, you know, the director would usually get that stuff. But again, our show, we know that stuff so much earlier on. So I'm kind of just feeding that stuff casually to the guest director throughout the season. So, you know, and often they're on different projects, but I just keep them up speed on everything. So they'll get those references so early that they'll be able to not just say, okay, I know you want that, but they'll be able to ingest it a little bit, spin it around a little bit, feel it out. Hey, how does that feel? Or actually, I want to do something different. You know, do you mind if I reach out to Henry and Akiva and, you know, do I have a different take on this? Can I do that? That happens too. So that's the benefit, again, of having this stuff early. This isn't really a Star Trek thing. It's more my thing. Or, you know, personally, I mean, obviously, you know, cinema is a spiritual guide of my life. But when I'm actually making my own thing, when I'm directing, you know, I try not to reference other works of cinema, Star Trek or otherwise, which I try to pull my influences, my inspiration out of the script and material itself. So I can only speak how I work, but you know, with Star Trek, obviously is unique, you know, the canon is vast, and the fans expect that connection and embrace of it. But we never say it has to be like, you know, you never get like the elevator pitch for an episode. Like, this is, you know, DS9 this meets TOS this, that, like, they'll never get something that sort of basic and say to go off of. Unlike other shows I've been on, there's a lot of room for a director to, and a lot of time, you know, because time is always the enemy of directing, a time for a director to spin the plates themselves, come up with their own take on it, and really pitch it.
Can you think of a specific example, like an episode where a director really did shift something that was in the game plan?
Yeah, I would say Dermot, the musical. So Henry and I did The Magicians together for 5 years. And one of the things about The Magicians is we made a musical pretty much every season. I don't think the first, not the first two seasons, but season 3, 4, and 5. So I had experience not only working with Henry, one of our showrunners, but working on him with musicals. But we never did original songs, and we never did, and we only did like, you know, 3 or 4 songs per episode, much smaller in scale than this. So this was brand new for us, for me, and I've never been involved with something like this, having 10 original songs, 10 original recordings, dance, choreography, everything like that. And, you know, I will admit, in my mind, I had trouble sort of totally visualizing it. And again, I think Akiva drove this boat, really. I had been throwing them some director names early on. And maybe they could see, you know, maybe they could hear my voice. Like when I was talking about it, I'm like, what the fuck is Fish talking about? Like, does he really know what he's talking about? Like, I didn't really, you know, I was like, you know, I'm not a musical guy. Like, I don't know. So they're like, you really have to hire just someone who's done this. And of course, as you guys know, Dermot had done an amazing job before. And so he came in and he really saw it and he really shaped it and he really changed it. And he got super involved in the choreography, the recordings, everything. We flew him up way early. He started his prep way early. He was going in and recording with the actors over the weekends, changing songs, giving notes, moving things. Same with the choreography, same with the dance. I mean, he really shaped and changed that episode because, you know, I don't know why we were so insane to do that. Like, the 208 was a giant episode. The Klingon battle, like that. We had never used our AR wall like that before, so we were so overwhelmed with that episode. And then, of course, we had the finale that Maya directed, which again was so overwhelming to reconstruct this entire city. Like, so we were so completely overwhelmed and by these episodes bookending this musical, and then we had this giant musical. So Dermot really had the chance to sort of shape it, and that's what he did. I would say that episode was as much his voice as anything else.
Have you ever had to say no? Like, has a director ever gone too far, or tried to, you know, pitch something that just wouldn't work in Star Trek? Like, it's too violent or it's too campy or that kind of stuff. Does that come up a lot?
We did do Klingon K-pop, so I guess if I ever pulled out the campy wand, that would have been it. And not that we didn't have a lot of discussions about that. And not that we also didn't shoot a backup version of that song. We did.
What was the style of the backup version?
Oh, man. I think it's like opera or something. I think it was opera. No,
like Klingon opera or human
Klingon
opera?
Opera. yeah, we should release it. It should maybe I can imagine that'll come out in the DVD extras. But yeah, there was enough cold feet with Klingon K-pop that we thought that we did shoot recorded a song, everything, backup version of that, you know. So yeah, that's kind of funny.
Well, people loved it, so there you go.
There you go. As far as the no to other directors, I mean, certainly that's a part of my job. I don't. Maybe it's selective memory that I don't remember. I mean, I don't. I haven't had a director experience where that was a defining element of it by any means, you know. I can't say that I've had to play director cop much at all on the show. Not that everything works. Not that everything works in my episodes. And again, it's not a way around the question. But I think also our scripts are very good, and they're very clear. And you know, there's not a lot of confusion as to what the genre is and what the emotive moments are, You know, the only way a director really can fail on our show, other than, you know, being terrible, but the only way you can fail on our show is to not put character first, is to think you're doing a big action scene and not putting the character first, or think you're trying to make the joke really funny and not putting the character first. If you ever get ahead of character, if anything ever gets in front of character, that scene's not going to work. It's not going to work for our showrunners. It's not going to work for our fans. We all know great television. You know, you all know you like, when a great TV show is on year 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know it's a great show because all you're doing is watching these characters that you love. You know what I mean? Everything, even though everything might look great, you're just falling. And that was always sort of the goal here. Like, let's create these characters that people love. And we know they love them. That's the benefit of doing a prequel to TOS is like, you know, we have 2020 is hindsight, and we're using that to our best advantage. Like, these are the best characters ever created for television. And we get to tell their backstory and introduce them. And so that's what it's about. It's always been so character driven. And look, I'll say, hey, when did a director not do a great job? Myself, you know, on the premiere this year, I was so in love with these action sequences with Babs and Jess and the Klingons that, you know, I think I probably overemphasized some of that stuff. You know, I'm not immune to director hubris either. You know, sometimes you can get carried away with something. But our best episodes or my favorite episodes are always the ones that are character driven, and the directors who do the best jobs are the ones that always put the character first.
This is a more technical question, but I mean, there is a fairly consistent lighting on your show. And this is one of the most controversial things about Picard season 3. I don't know if you watch that, but they brought in a new DP and they went for the cinematic style. What if a director wanted to go more cinematic, wanted to go darker? Like, or is that something you would say, nope, you know, we have our lighting style, stick with it?
No, we do. I mean, that question came up specifically in 104 Memento Mori directed by Dan Liu, you know, and, you know, we went for it, you know. Our metaphor for that was a sinking submarine, you know, and so that was, we went as dark as we could with that. Look, you can't go that dark on our show because all our walls are white, you know, so our production, so you're in a white box, right? So, a lot of lighting is one thing that appears in front of the camera. And of course, the other thing is the, you know, paint color and reflective material. You know, and there's only so much you can do to deal with a shiny white cylinder. So that very much informs our visual language, our palette, our color and stuff like that. But we take, and also in 109, you know, we tried to make it as dark as possible. That stuff is embraced. For example, on 110, I used a whole different set of lenses. I didn't want to, we have these really beautiful lenses that don't have a lot of good, really good close focus. And I wanted to get really up, like, especially on the Romulan ship, I wanted to feel really claustrophobic. I wanted the lens right up in their faces. So we changed our whole lens package. So you can come in and you can say, I want to use a different camera, a different lens. I want to light this totally different. And we'd say yes.
Given the range of genres that you guys cover in a season, does the tone of the episode actually affect the mood on set when you're filming? Like, some are comedies and some are really dark and gritty and then others are light. Does that affect the team, the actors?
No, I mean, we don't really have any method kind of actors or anything like that. They're pretty congenial and fun and kind all the time. They hate the spacesuits. The spacesuits are uncomfortable and sweaty and and the helmets hurt and so that can affect the mood on set.
That's a Star Trek tradition, is hating those things.
Oh my God. I know. And look, we inherited them from Disco. We had to refab them, and every season we refab them a little bit more to make them slightly less painful. But, the genre doesn't affect the episode. The director's personality certainly does. You know, having someone like Jonathan Frakes or something like that come do our show is sort of a lifeline to so much history and joy. And, you know, he kind of wears that. He's just such a gentleman, but he wears that really on his sleeve. And so every episode is very, going back to, this is a show that we do 10 Star Trek movies. Every episode is very much the personality of the director.
Was it nuts filming the crossover?
No. I mean, again, like, and look, and so when I
mean, in a good way,
how hard 208 was, and how hard 209 was, and how two. So the crossover was kind of like, oh, he got an easy one. And then of course it was not anything but easy. The animation took a long time, and it was funny, at early on, there wasn't really the the budget to do the credit sequence and animation. But I think once they saw the cut, they realized how good it was. And they're like, yeah, we'll find that money somewhere. Because that credit sequence and animation was so dope. That was so great. Tawny and Jack were amazing. Our actors loved them. If you're shipping Ethan and Jack, like those two, those guys are, I mean, that I've never, like, they were like best friends. And same with Tawny and Celia. And it was a total love affair. But again, like, that's an episode. Like, I mean, like, come on. Like, if I hired anyone but Jonathan Frakes to do that episode, I should be fired. I mean, like, he was the perfect guy for that. Like, the perfect guy for that. And that's what was fun. It's fun when you get it. It's fun when you hit a home run because everyone feels it. You hire the right director. You got a great script. And you got Jack and Tawny in town. And, like, everyone's going out to dinner. It's just like, I mean, it was beyond fun. Feels good. Everyone wants to get a slam dunk like that.
Something that I'm sure changes the mood is when you guys go on location, especially in the winter in Toronto.
Yeah.
When you guys did the time travel episode, were you surprised by how quickly people spotted Paul Wesley on the streets? We were wondering, like, was Paramount surprised that this was going to happen? Because it's like he's walking around, you know, Toronto. People are going to notice that.
A major street corner, like a big intersection in Toronto, too.
Well, God, I could talk about Paul for so long. I love Paul so much. I mean, I can't believe, like, the poor guy, like, the nerves, you know, like, I mean, stepping into those boots, and luckily he had, you know, Ethan to talk to and Sally to talk to, but then he had to play three versions of the character, like three timelines. Like, can we make it any harder for this guy? Like, not only do you have to come play Kirk, but you have to do it in three different versions. And like, they're like, and he nailed every one of them. And it really feels like the fans are behind him, and they should be, because he's such a fantastic guy and he loves the role so much. I've been able to direct a lot with him. Just randomly, you know, I actually directed the season one finale with him, but then there were some COVID issues in his other episodes, so I ended up getting to direct a lot of his scenes in other episodes. So I've had the pleasure of working a lot with him. I don't think anyone knew how big of a star he was. I mean, I didn't, but I soon realized when, he was walking through the center of Toronto, and like, there's 5,000, it's like the Beatles, you know. We just kind of rolled with it. I think he has something like 15 million Instagram followers or something like that. So, yeah, we just rolled with it. I mean, we don't shoot on location very often, and the reason is we have this amazing technology called the AR wall, the volume. We are the first show ever to be designed, to conceive from the ground up, from day one, to be built for AR. Now, The Mandalorian definitely started using it after they kind of invented their show, but we launched this show, and this is a testament to Alex Kurtzman and Akiva and Henry. You know, Toronto has many amazing benefits. I truly believe it's the best place to make cinema, as I said earlier, but it's the worst place to shoot. It's got terrible locations, terrible weather. It's not close to any other good locations or good weather. It's a great place to do a big stage show, but it's a terrible place for a show called Strange New Worlds. Like, how many times can we go to the same quarry and call it a Strange New World? So we were really up against it because we didn't want to shoot anywhere else but Toronto. So the show had to be designed very early on. You had to think of the show in one of two ways. One, this is a very light, nimble show that we're going to have some standing sets in Toronto, but we're going to be able to fly to Morocco or fly to Iceland or fly, like, we're going to be light and nimble. And this, we're going to design a show with this crazy schedule and crazy budget. And that's what we're going to make. And look, some shows do shoot that way. You know, some of the Game of Thrones, they have a season, they block it. They have an Iceland team and then they have a Morocco team. So there's ways to do that. But that wasn't going to work for us in some way. That wasn't going to work for our 10 directors and 10 episodes things. We didn't want a block shoot. And we didn't want our episodes to all look the same. We wanted 10 different movies. So we really we're at the forefront of AR technology and shooting on the volume. And we literally built this show for this technology. So our show 100% was going to succeed or fail on how we use this technology. And I say that now without shaking, but when we made this decision, I had no idea how this technology worked. And this was my job. This was my responsibility. I was the one in charge of it. And I did what any, top TV director would do. I just started watching all the behind the scenes of Mandalorian to see what I could learn. that was my, and luckily we have this amazing team. Jason Zimmerman, our VFX producer, is a genius and a genius at this. Same with our DP, Glenn Keenan. So we created this whole new department. It's called Virtual Art Department, VAD. And it's myself, Glenn Keenan, our DP, Benji Bakshi, our DP, Ian Anderson, our DP, Jonathan Lee, our production designer, and Jason Zimmerman, our visual effects producer. And we took all these people from production, someone from post, and we put them together and we started building these worlds inside this volume in this AR technology. And very quickly, for people who have no idea what I'm talking about, is what we do on Strange New Worlds to create our worlds is we don't shoot on green screen generally. Occasionally we do. We still sometimes do old school VFX. But what we do is we build our worlds not in post, not with green screen. We build them in prep 4 months before we ever start shooting. Like Kajitar for 201, we started building that over 4 months before day one of shooting. We build our worlds using Unreal Engine technology, which is the software that runs video games. And we, instead of playing it back on the, we build these worlds polygon by polygon with our team of artists. Again, it's our DPs, our production design, all these VFX, all these different departments building these digital worlds together. And then we project these worlds on a giant sort of sound stage that looks like a horseshoe with a ceiling. And so instead of the actors coming to set and walking onto a green screen, they're walking into these worlds. These are real worlds. So 208, the Klingon battlefield, that's real. We have animated Klingon birds of prey flying overhead. Every episode, all the worlds that you're seeing, they're not built in post by VFX artists. They're built in prep by our DP, by our production designer, by our VFX producer, just a whole different way of thinking. So, and there's so many benefits, not least of which the actors get to actually act in the world that they're supposed to be in, the setting they're supposed to be in. I would say that is the game changer for our show visually. What's made our show succeed and look fantastic. It was an all in or all out choice. We went all in. I would say the big thing about season two, is we really learned the technology better and we really improved it. I think now we're extremely confident with it that what we do seasons three and beyond are going to be truly mind blowing.
I mean, I've talked a lot about this on the pod, and I've actually been critical at times, especially at Discovery, which was using it before you guys, where they were just like, oh, let's make a round set, and it was obvious they were just starting using this technology. And so it was clear, like, oh, this is the AR wall. It's obvious it's the AR wall. Whereas, like, some people were blown away by Mandalorian saying, I can't believe that wasn't shot on location. And so I've seen you guys improve, and I'm curious where you could see this going. What are things you'd like to do in the AR wall set, like perhaps having the characters move around more, that kind of stuff, but what are some of these things you think you guys could now do for seasons three or four?
Yeah, well, you're not limited with blocking, really, and you shouldn't feel that way. The stage is fairly large. We're excited to do all sorts of things. We're excited to land shuttles on the wall. We're excited to have more animation on the wall. We're excited to, our engineering set, our mess hall set, those are Amort sets. So we're not just building worlds. We're building phenomenal scope and scale sets that would never be able to afford on any movie budget, let alone a TV budget. We're able to build those sets and we go back to them. We go back to engineering all the time. So that's, we've realized the benefit of that. So for Star Trek in general, you know, sure, we're the beneficiary of this technology and we're learning it and we're going to pass it, not only pass on what we've learned to all the next Star Trek shows, but we're going to be able to pass on a library of these sets, you know? So right. This engineering, all these, every world that we've been to is now going to be available to any other Star Trek show. So, and it's, you know, these are, these would not be, be very cost prohibitive. Like, let's say you did have the money to go build a Khajiitar, you know, like the old way, you know, well, then that would have to be, the stage would be one of these gigantic stages in Ireland or something like that. And then you'd have to hold it in that stage for as many years as you wanted to keep it and constantly touch it up and paint it. You know, we build these digital worlds and then you save it and you download it and then you bring it back up when you use it. So if you think of Star Trek, if I had to say where is Star Trek going to be in 10 years from now, you're going to have every Star Trek show, and hopefully there's plenty of them, is going to have a digital backlot. You're going to have a digital backlot if everything that Disco does, everything that we do, everything that, you know, if Starfleet Academy goes, everything that they do. So you're going to have all these shows creating this big digital backlot of all these Star Trek worlds. And you're not stuck with them. You can tweak them and color them and change them and light them differently. So they never look stale because you can very easily update them. It really is beyond exciting. It's the future of filmmaking, of having these digital backlots. I'm also very much a conservationist at heart, and long distance shooting has a lot of problems. You know, you're flying an entire cast and crew to, like, let's say you go shoot in Machu Picchu. You know, you're going to go fly an entire cast and crew there. You have to put everyone up in hotels. You trample the site. There's, you know, taking a film crew to sensitive, beautiful places is problematic and expensive. And let's say you get there and then it's raining. Like on the wall, you have you have magic hour, the perfect lighting for as long as you want it. It really is a filmmaker's dream come true. And especially from a director point of view, to be involved in these worlds, you know, every guest director gets to light their own world and set their own world. Like Jonathan Frakes gets there and I want those mountains bigger, bring that mountain closer. Like you can't do that in a real location. And you definitely can't do that with old school VFX because that's happening 4 months after the director's gone. So you've taken the director out of the visual making process. AR has taken the director, the production designer, the DP, and put them back in the forefront of world building. And that's why I think Star Trek Strange New Worlds, our worlds look so great. We have our best visual thinkers, our best visual artists making these worlds. And you're right. You know, some of them season one seemed a little stagey. We didn't know exactly what we were doing. I think we improved a lot season two. And we're going to improve a lot season three. And it's the technology is moving faster than you could believe. And, you know, I know we were talking about AI earlier, and I think there's probably a very fair use of AI for AR. Right. I think there might be a lot of benefit for using AI to help build these worlds, you know, or enhance these worlds and affect these worlds with the camera a little bit differently. And I don't want to bore everyone with the technical side of things, but there is a depth of field issue with the walls that we haven't really been able to figure out technically, but we're hoping that maybe an AI algorithm might give us some benefit there.
I don't know how much you can get into this, but I know that, you know, production was supposed to start way back in April and it couldn't, obviously, because of, you know, obvious reasons. But are these guys building season three already? You know, are you already seeing season three, the virtual sets?
So we were up to episode 307 with AR. So we had a you know, as I said, we had a document, you know, here's your 10 genres, here's your 10 worlds, and we were into 307 when we shut down, and we were doing some exciting stuff. We found a way now to use it in almost every episode. And again, if it's not used in an episode, then then often like we that's a great episode to bring up engineering or bring up one of these one of our AMORT standing sets which are LCAR. But yeah, so we like I said, in our discussion about how early we start, we were almost done with season three AR by the time we shut down for the strike.
But because the showrunners are on strike, even though none of the artists are on strike, they didn't continue working because there's no supervision, essentially.
Our showrunners are everything. So yeah, as soon as those guys were off the ticket, we shut down. So yeah, I mean, we shut down. I stayed up in Toronto for 2 weeks. I was really optimistic. I was like, this is going to blow over. No, but this is so I was so wrong. Everything I thought was wrong. But we'll get right back on it. And look, the show is the show is such a huge hit, not just ratings wise and not just review wise, but really spiritually. I think the show really was the right show for the right time. You know, coming out of COVID, it's optimistic. You know, it hits all of Roddenberry's these truths that we've seen that have lasted through Trek. Like, it really was the right show at the right time, and it feels good making it. Everything I've heard from the studio is they can't wait to get back on the horse as well. We just, once the strike is over, fingers crossed, I don't think it's going to be long till we're back up and running. I was directing the first episode. I was going to direct the premiere. I don't know if I still will anymore, because once we come back, there's going to be a whole shuffle around probably. But I was ready. You know, I had storyboarded pretty much the entire first episode. That's how close we were to starting shooting. We were one day away from flying the actors in. And that's kind of like, that's where, like, do we fly the actors in? And then, you know, that's when it kind of went above my pay scale. And in hindsight, again, I thought it was going to blow over. But I was like, you know, I'm a director, so I'm like, bring him in, let's just shoot, let's get something done. I'm like the guy in the trenches, like the sun's going down and it's raining, you still have two scenes left. I'm like, let's just shoot. Like, you know, my idea is, you know, you shoot until they tell you to stop. But luckily, there's smarter people than me making these decisions, and they pulled the plug on us.
What if, like, magic happened? The governor of California comes in and says, cuts a deal, and all the strikes are over on Friday. How long would it take to get shit happening? Or have you guys picked a date just to pick a date, you know, in the future anyway?
Well, so kind of what we're doing right now, and this isn't official by any means, myself and the producers up in Toronto, we keep kind of like, we'll kind of say, okay, there's a date. Like, let's say the end of this month. And what would happen? What would we need to do to then get going? And then once the strike passes that, then we set it for the next month. We're not that many weeks away from being able to start. Absent all the other conflicts which may have risen by now, you know, who knows? Who knows what everyone's doing, you know? And, all these, you know, like.
Would you guys, because I know that the Section 31, I mean, they've, if they could get going, they want to get going in the fall because they've got Michelle Yeoh and her schedule. Would that hurt you guys if that, you know, or are you guys on different stages?
I don't think it would hurt us. You know, obviously Olatunde and, you know, that whole crew is, you know, that's our family. So we'd work it out. Like, that's a great thing about Trek. Like, this really isn't hyperbole or something. Like, it really feels like a family. We just work it out. We worked it out with Disco season one, sharing the wall and sharing everything. And, Tunde is an incredible guy. And so, you know, a lot of that, again, those kind of things, that's kind of also falls into what my job would be like, hey, like, you know, this is what here's the stages we want. Here's the stuff we want. How do we work this out and start figuring that out?
You used their sets for 201.
We use those sets for a lot of things. You know, there's so many. We use those sets for all the time, which we repurpose it and reset them. I use it for the Romulan ship in 110. That was also a Disco set that repurposed. Yeah, yeah. There's like we share everything. We share. You know, Tunde was going up there to work, and I was like, "Go stay at my place for free," because I still had my place booked for the thing. So, you know, there's a lot of goodwill. It's not like two separate shows that have to go figure out how to start on time. Because I guess what you're saying is, aren't you guys probably sharing a lot of crew and equipment and locations. Yeah. we are. But like those are people all in the family. So they'll come work for us and they'll work it out. And hey, like, you know, they'll Tunde will say, hey, we have a really great DP, Glenn, and a really great AD, this guy Woody. And Tunde will say, I want Woody and Glenn for these two episodes. And then you can have them after that. I'm like, fine. You know, we'll work it out. So all that kind of stuff happens all under the, since we're all under the, you know, the Secret Hideout umbrella.
That's so Star Trek-y of all of you.
You know, it really is Star Trek-y. There's not a lot of elbows out. God, I'm so, so excited about Section 31. And I really hope that, I mean, they're so close. After so long, they're so close. Everything I've heard is that the latest script is phenomenal. I haven't read the very latest one, but I don't see why, if they strike end, they said go. I don't see any why everything Star Trek couldn't start up and start get going. You know what I mean?
How long? I mean, realistically, you know, people on the show. I think Alex once joked, "Well, you know, 7 years." That's a good run for a Star Trek show. But do people, you know, the people on the show, how long do they see this show running realistically?
I mean, I've never talked to my bosses about that, but I have an opinion. I don't know why this show wouldn't go forever. I mean, I don't understand. I don't know why there has to be an artificial shelf life. You know, I don't feel like, you know, as amazing as our showrunners have done, I think everyone feels like we just scratched the surface here. Like we haven't even begun to really push this boundary of genre. Like, I think season one was great, and season two we improved and we got bigger and better and did all these great things. But like, there's so much more to do. Obviously, narratively, emotionally, we know where this show is going, but how long it takes to get there, is anyone's guess. And, I would like the show to go on, I'd like this to be show to be 10 seasons. I'd also like to be making 20 episodes a season, you know?
That's what I was going to ask you is, do you think it's realistic to think they'll ever expand the number of shows per season?
I have no idea. Nobody talks to me about that kind of stuff. That's where my executive producer VIP card doesn't work, you know. But I don't know why not. I mean, I made 22 episodes of Person of Interest for Jonah and JJ. We made 22 great episodes a season. But
doesn't this show take roughly 2 weeks to shoot an episode?
Yeah, so I'm not saying we do 22, but I think we could do 15.
Discovery, when they started, they had more episodes in a season.
I mean, you start getting into a log jam. You know, the hard thing is post in the writer's room. What you're kind of saying is like, we're never taking a hiatus, right?
Unless you take huge breaks.
Right. I mean, I'm just a workhorse. You know, you're asking the blue collar exec producer what he wants to do. And I'm like, put me in, coach. You know, I just want to go hit some balls. So I'll let the big brain bugs worry about how to finish the scripts and stuff like that. Yeah, I just love doing it. I mean, I love this cast. I think that's the other thing to mention, which is so clear after season two, and how did we improve the show? What changed season two? I think we figured out that our ensemble cast, every single one of them is a star. On captain driven Trek shows, which, maybe DS9 is a difference a little bit, but we realize that every single, and we knew Anson is a star. I mean, Anson is, there is no other person than Captain. There's no Captain Pike other than Anson, but I think we realize every one of our ensemble characters could be their own spinoff. I mean, they're that good. And we're talking like people who are relatively unknown. Like, we knew Rebecca was awesome and we knew Ethan was awesome because season two of Disco, right? Chrissy and Babs and Jess and Celia and Melanie, who's come on the supporting cast is so incredible. Melissa, they're just amazing. So I think, when you start looking at the show, certainly I think it could go on for many seasons, and certainly there's opportunities for spinoffs. But who knows? Maybe they go make TOS next again, which you know, there's some excitement there. But I really like this world. I really like this prequel world. That's really fun to direct in. I'm sure it's really fun to write into. I'd have to let the showrunners know. It's really fun to direct Spock before we know Spock. It's really fun to direct Uhura before you know Uhura, and it's fun to see them make mistakes and. No one's a straight line, right? And we all have these ups and downs and these struggles. And, you know, I know it was fun watching some of the fans get mad about human Spock this year. But, like, as a director, like, the more that, the better. Because, like, you know, that's – of course he was young and did things. Like I don't know. It's just – it's really the creative energy and excitement and pleasure and joy – of doing the show, doing this prequel to tell the story of these characters that are so beloved in this early state is really beyond anything I've ever experienced as a director. And if anyone asked me for my vote, I'd say more is more.
I'm loving the characters. Like, I'm right there with you. We're very invested in them. And I'm just wondering, there's a history in Star Trek of the older shows before this new era where the cast would want to change a line of dialogue, a moment, how they reacted to something on set. And it was a whole, you had to make a phone call. It took 20 minutes to track down the writer to get permission for the slightest syllable. And I'm wondering how much, I assume it's not that atmosphere. And I'm just wondering how much input they have since they're really getting to know their own character so well too. Like, is that a more collaborative environment?
Yeah, but I'd also say there's a lot of respect for the script, but there is no rigid process or there's none of that stuff. And I know that world. I mean, two of my big mentors were Mary Howard, who is a producer, who's and then probably a man who's like a second father to me is this guy Marvin Rush, who was a DP on I think 250 episodes of Trek.
Yeah,
and Marvin really taught me filmmaking, and Mary taught me how to be a producer. So I know all the stories of Trek production back in the day and how challenging. And look, I mean, you can imagine a person in my show would say that wouldn't spill any dirt, but I actually would spill dirt if I knew it. None of that stuff happens. Like, it really is, they respect the script. They love the script. When a line doesn't work, they change it to make it work. And everyone knows it was done for the right reasons. You know, it's super collaborative. Part of the strange thing about the writer's strike is that everything that the writers are asking for already happens on our show. So there's always a writer on set, and myself and the directors are the most fortunate people to have those writers on set. And the actors love it. And like, we're all there together. There's no sidebars. There's no, hey, I don't like the script. I'm not going to tell anyone. If we don't like this, we read the script out loud in rehearsal. And if we don't like it, we make it work. But 99% of the time, the script's bananas good. So, you know, we just keep doing different versions of it and try things. And yeah, there's no red phone to the president's office where there's the nuclear button. You know, that's not on our show.
The showrunners, the big brains, as you were just saying, recently talked about season three as if it's just going to be, I forget the phrase Akiva used, was season two on steroids or something like that. So, yeah. But more big swings, more genres. So now you're looking at a new board of 10 episodes, 10 new worlds. And like last season you had crossover and musical. Like, are you looking at any words up there that are just like scaring the shit out of you? Like, oh my God.
Every one of the words up there scares the shit out of me. I mean, the show is terrifying to make, and to know that my boss is, you know, an Oscar-winning writer, and my first job directing was directing his script. I mean, I'm terrified, but that's the best thing about the job. If it wasn't exciting like that, you weren't challenged like that, you know, it wouldn't be what it is. But yeah, they're big swings. They're definitely big swings. And my guess is that they're all going to stick, but the AR wall and scripts are an immovable object and an unstoppable force. So you do not want those things to collide. You want those things to run parallel, right? Because you cannot move the AR wall, the dates. It's like a Goliath. So what we try to do is we try to line up scripts in the AR wall to go side by side. That said, we're never totally successful, and we always run out of something, and we're always juggling. And so we were ahead on AR sets. We were further ahead on AR sets than we were on scripts. So in this 3-4 months, 10 years, however long it takes for the studios to get their brains back, you know, who knows? Maybe they've rethought, maybe they'll rethink some of that. I'm sure they've been thinking about these scripts, even though they haven't been writing them. But yeah, you know, obviously I can't say anything about season 3, but yeah, what I see up on the wall scares the heck out of me.
So season 2 was mostly written and produced before season 1 even aired. Mm-hmm. And so you didn't get a chance to get the fan reaction before you were working on that. So has the reaction since then affected season 3, because now you have had some time?
Look, you can imagine a response to season 1 where my answer would be totally different. If it didn't work, yeah, you know. But no, I mean, because we loved making it, we thought they were amazing, we thought they were going to be big hits, and then they were. So it didn't affect season 2, and it won't affect season 3. I it was so vivid, and I'm sure everyone's heard this a million times because it's kind of folklore by now. The pitch, you know, generally, so when I get my job, when I'm the producing director, I generally go and meet with the showrunners, and, you know, it can get very detailed and elaborate, and, you know, you're talking, you know, what daytime lighting, what nighttime lighting, like, oh, you're very detailed, like literally the pitch for the show was, and this is from Akiva Henry, is like, hey guys, let's just go make Trek. Let's just make Trek. Like, that's what, like, so I'm, and like, you know, so I'm like waiting, like, and it took me a second. I'm like, that's it. Like, this is a 5-second meeting. I had never had a clearer directive ever, because I knew what they meant. I knew exactly what they meant. Like, let's just go make Trek. Let's not reinvent the wheel here. Let's go make Trek, and and of course, let's use everything we have at our disposal, from AR to, you know, these incredible, beautiful Cook Special Prime lenses, like, you know, to make it cinema. But we were making Trek, so that's what we did season 1. And again, it felt like it was working. You know, I've certainly been on shows that haven't been hits. I'm lucky to have been, this is my 4th kind of hit show in a row. I did Warehouse 13, then I did Person of Interest and Magician. So I've been nice to be on a little bit of a runner here, thankfully to the phenomenal showrunners and writers that I've been working for. But I knew, I guess I didn't know. I mean, I could tell that the show was awesome. you know, it was just too much fun to make. It's like, well, how would this not work? Like, you know, and look, I mean, thank you so much to Disco. Like, season 2 of Disco, we knew it worked, right?
Yeah,
you saw that chemistry. You like, and not that those characters are in the same place, but like, you knew Anson Mount was Captain Pike, you know, and everything else is kind of gravy, right? And then the gravy was amazing, because all these, like I said, all these ensemble cast members were so amazing. But you know, Akiva and Henry would have to answer the part about the writers' room, but we made zero adjustments creatively. For production, you know, camera, lighting, anything. We just, you know, we're perfectionists, and we wanted to improve and do everything better. But we there was no like learning lesson taken from season 1 that we're like, okay, we the fans really didn't like this, or the fans, like, everyone's bumming out on this. We, like, there was none of those conversations that happened.
You guys are really leaning into the AR wall, which is obviously very digital, but you're also leaning heavily into the work done by practical guys, like Legacy. Like, someone had to decide, when we do the Gorn, someone could have easily said, let's just do it digitally. And especially with the AR wall, you know, like, you guys are big into digital, but you guys said, no, let's not do it. Like, was that a difficult decision? And is this kind of, you know, can we expect more? Because, you know, I love old-fashioned practical effects, you know, but it's not always what people choose these days.
Look, I don't want to sound too egotistical, say that we do all these things differently in a unique way, but we deal with this very differently and very uniquely. We've said over and over that we're going to make the best creatures, and the best creatures are going to be both practical and visual effects. And we need every one of us working together. So we don't just concept with Legacy. We don't just concept with our VFX team. both of those guys are working together day one. They're concepting together. They don't usually work together. I don't think they work together on any other shows. You know, and there's not without some sort of, you know, team building that needs to happen to get that to work. You know, because you have an art form which is considered by some people to be outdated, and then an art form which is, you know, but like, I couldn't disagree more. You need both. You need claws to grab and crawl into. You need a face to push up. It's like we need real creatures. We're a character driven show. It's not like you can't see something at 50 feet. You have to interact with it. But you know, I truly believe the best art comes from using all the best artists and working in collaboration to make it happen. So we have Alan's team at Legacy and Jay-Z's team on the VFX. They worked hand in hand on every shot of the Gorn. And I will say that I think 90% of the shots of the Gorn, at least 90%, are both prosthetic and VFX. Because we were like, hey, why would we spend an hour of shoot time on a set trying to get this thing to blink the right way? Blink could be done by VFX. But the eyeball, we want to see that thing. We want to see it. We want to see it glisten. We want to put goop on it. We want to be able to touch it. We want to see the reflections of the room on it. That eyeball needs to be prosthetic, you know? So we had like the Gorn fight, the Zero-G Gorn fight. The entire fight was done with a Gorn in the suit, a prosthetic thing. You know, it was incredibly difficult. Maya Vavrilo, our director, did an incredible job. That whole thing could have aired practically. But VFX ended up touching almost every shot. Why? And you said that, well, if VFX was going to touch every shot, why didn't you just have VFX do the whole thing to begin with? Because it doesn't look good. You need both, and you need both working together. So, you know, and I think maybe some of the initial interest in, you know, now we know it works. So we'll do everything we can to keep Legacy as a core partner in the show. But I think maybe to begin with, maybe there was some thought that, oh, we don't need to do this. But because of the TOS connection, I think there was at least a sort of an interest in trying to do a little bit with things a little bit more old school. And we've just found a real sweet spot and a great way in how to do it.
I think, I mean, Lori, do you have anything else? I think we've taken up your
200
whole day.
More questions, but I feel like we gotta call it. I mean, we'd love to have you back to talk more, because I feel like we on our own list, we still have a whole bunch of stuff, and I'm thinking of new things every time you say something, I'm thinking of new things that I want to ask you about. So,
well, I would love to come back, and I'd love to get some of our directors on too. Like, we really have phenomenal directors and phenomenal people. And I feel like it truly is like a dream team, and we get the best directors in town. So,
such a creative atmosphere.
It is.
Yeah, it's great.
It is, until someone screws it all up, but they haven't done it yet. So, yeah. You know, I'm sure. Look, I mean, knock on wood, but we haven't had a slow dog in the race yet.
Well, you know, it's been more than a pleasure. It's been fun and enlightening.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you guys so much. That's really fun, and thanks again for all your work and for supporting the show.
That was our interview with Chris Fisher, and we will definitely have him return to the podcast to talk about season 3. We'll be back next week as our Star Trek Discovery final season countdown begins. We'll have new interviews with cast members and producers for you. See you then.